At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The week that was, because it's Friday, then a blast from the past with tariffs, and then sustainable energy from the American home of oil and gas. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today. This one is the 8th day of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This has been, relatively speaking, a data light week in this economy. So we're going to try to keep things big picture. Here to do that with us are Gina Smilek. She is at the New York Times. Amara Mokwe is at the Wall Street Journal. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
So lots of Fed talkers this week, Amara, including one on this program, Austin Goolsbee, the president of the Chicago Fed. He said a bunch of stuff. You know, we ran like an 8-minute interview with him. And one of the things he said that I tried to nail him down on, and honestly, I failed, was how much more the Fed is going to need to see before it says, okay, we're done. You know, he gave me the standard data, we need to see data thing. And then I said, Austin, look, there's all kinds of data that shows things are going pretty well. And he said, yeah, no, we need to see more. And my question is, how long is it sustainable for the Fed to keep saying, yeah, we just need to see more?
I think as long as they feel like they want to do that. I mean, I feel like that is going to continue to be their answer because they are really concerned about getting inflation down in a way where it's going to stay down, right? And they want to, as a lot of the Fed officials have said over and over, they want to stay nimble. They want to stay data dependent. And so I feel like they're going to continue to be in this mode where they give themselves the flexibility. I know that most of us are expecting them to pause in September, mm-hmm. but they want to give themselves the flexibility to hike again if they need to, if they feel like they need to, or take policy in whatever direction they feel like they need to as the data come in.
So Gina, what I hear Amara saying is they want to keep it fast and loose and easy. Is that fair?
The right. Opposite of easy. They want to
not policy. You're right. I'm talking to an actual Fed reporter as a guy who plays one on the radio. They want to just be able to hang out and do whatever they feel they need to do, right? And not bind themselves.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good description. They basically want to keep all of their options open, everything on the table here. You know, I think that really reflects the very uncertain moment we're in. You know, there are times when the Fed wants to tell markets exactly what's coming next because it mm-hmm. thinks that that'll sort of help everybody to adjust and, you know, get everybody prepared and that will actually make their jobs a little bit easier. But this is distinctly not one of those times. Like the Fed's main goal right now is to give themselves enough flexibility to react if the data surprise them, which is not a big surprise given that we've had basically 2 years of rapid inflation mm-hmm. that very much surprised the Fed. You know, they thought it was going to be transitory. Then even when they accepted it wasn't going to be transitory, they didn't think it would go as high as it did. Then they didn't think it would stick around as long as it did. And they just don't want to be caught out in that position again, where it just ends up being more persistent or worse than they had anticipated it would be. And they haven't sort of prepared the world for that.
All right, so Amara, I'm going to play a piece of tape from Goolsbee yesterday, and then we're going to discuss. Here we go.
There's clearly risks. I mean, if you look at China, if you look, we could have a government shutdown. There are a whole series of bumps in the road that we will have to navigate. And we have seen inflation start coming down before, and it was a bit of a false dawn, and inflation started to come back. So all of those are things we got to keep an eye on.
Bumps in the road. I mean, you know, he's not wrong. There's stuff that could go wrong, you know, every which way, including the UAW strike and the shutdown and all that jazz.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's why you've seen Fed officials really, as we've been talking about, just maintain this this flexible stance. I mean, even if we look at energy prices, you know, mm-hmm. that has been something that had been trending in the right direction. But in August, we think they probably will, you know, drive up headline inflation a little bit. So there are just all these, as he said, bumps in the road that they want to be able to navigate around.
Gina, let me ask you a super quick question about, and then I want to get off the Fed, about expectations, right? They talk a lot about expectations, inflation expectations among consumers remaining angered, which they are. How big a deal is that we're kind of okay with where things are now?
For them, I think it's a very big deal in the sense that it gives them the flexibility to kind of wait and see and feel around in the darkness and not feel too much urgency to just, you know, smack inflation down at any mm-hmm. cost. If we were in a world where inflation expectations were really high and the Fed was worried that today's sort of quick inflation was feeding into expectations of quick inflation tomorrow, mm-hmm. I think you'd be seeing a much more aggressive Fed than we currently are. So mm-hmm. I do think it gives them a lot of latitude.
Okay. All right. Same question for both of you. Amara, you get to go first. What are you looking at as you flip through your newsfeed in the morning or think about your coverage for the next 6 weeks? What are you looking at?
Biggest thing will be CPI next week. Just what we're going to see in the core and then what we're going to see in core prices, you know, excluding housing. We know that the Fed is watching that really quickly, closely. Yeah. And then also just thinking a lot about sort of the labor market and labor supply and what's going to continue contributing to the loosening of the labor market, right? Mm-hmm. That's something that the Fed is also watching really closely. And we've been seeing a lot of indications that the labor market is loosening, but just looking for signs that that is continuing.
Gina, same question. And do you take any solace from the fact that the labor market does, in fact, seem to be easing just a tad?
Yeah. So I think actually the labor market news is just incredibly important and interesting right now because it's going to mean so much for the Fed's path forward. I think it's, you know, sort of the be all end all when you're talking right. about how tight is the economy really. And I think there have been some interesting signs that there might be cracks forming that we're not fully seeing in the data yet. You know, the Wall Street Journal had a really interesting exclusive yesterday, basically saying that Walmart is kind of quietly mm-hmm. revising how it does mm-hmm. some of its wage levels so mm-hmm. that they're a little bit lower for some starting employees. You know, I think if we continue to see trends like that playing out, that could be really interesting input into this story. So I think definitely signs like that, anecdotal signs that the labor market is cooling more than we're seeing in the actual data yeah. will be worth watching.
Yeah. Gina Smilek at the New York Times, Amara Mokwe at the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, up, but without a whole lot of enthusiasm. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The data company Epic Bankruptcy, they track bankruptcy filings, they are not in protection themselves, said in a report this week that commercial bankruptcies of all stripes, that is big companies and small, were 17% higher in August this year than they were in July this year, and that makes 13 straight months that companies looking for protection from their creditors has gone up. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at how we got here and where we might be going.
For people who study bankruptcy, this trend is a long time coming. Ed Morrison is a law professor at Columbia.
What we're experiencing now is the fruit of seeds planted in the 2010s.
After the financial crisis, borrowing money was cheap, so companies on shaky footing could stay afloat. That was exacerbated by the pandemic, when interest rates fell again and relief programs bought businesses even more time. Morrison says now, bankruptcies have piled up.
Those failures are not harbingers of widespread economic problems in our economy. It's not to say that they don't have devastating impacts.
When bankruptcies are high, companies that have filed are less likely to survive. Sam Antle, a finance professor at Harvard, says it's harder to find a buyer.
Because suddenly there aren't that many viable buyers because all the people that have the right experience in this industry are in distress themselves.
This is happening in healthcare right now. Many senior care, pharma, and hospital companies have filed for bankruptcy this year. That affects consumers, who are left with fewer choices, and workers, who are more likely to lose their jobs. David Wessel is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He says in some ways, these bankruptcies are a symptom of the Federal Reserve trying to slow the economy.
You want them to do some, but not too much.
He says it doesn't look like we're in the too much territory yet. But a continued increase in filings could signal overcooling and could make banks tighten lending.
A bankruptcy that scares a banker can prevent somebody who wants to start a new business or expand their business from getting money.
That mostly hurts small businesses, which make up 99.9% of American business. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Remember back in the Trump administration when it felt like practically every business and economic story was about tariffs, the steel and aluminum tariffs that were supposed to target China but also pulled in Europe and Canada? Technically, we are still in that Trump-era trade war, although we should say that American tariffs of European metals are on pause and their retaliatory tariffs on us are as well, all of which I mention because Bloomberg has some reporting that says the U.S. and the EU, European Union, are working on a longer-term solution to the whole mess that would shift the focus of all the tariffing back to China. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams took today to check in on just where things stand in the kind of quiet trade war.
The Trump-era tariffs were imposed with the legal justification of protecting America's national security, but they were also about protecting America's steel and aluminum producers from cheaper Chinese imports. Now, says Erica York at the Tax Foundation,
we're really close to the same place we were when President Trump left office. President Biden has maintained most of the tariffs that were put in place back in 2018 and 2019.
But in 2021, the Americans and the Europeans made a temporary deal. Lehigh University's Marianne Madeira.
Where we stand today is that the Biden administration agreed to allow limited quantities of EU metals to enter the U.S. duty-free.
But that deal is set to expire at the end of October, says Charles Rees at the Rand Corporation.
The question is, can something a little bit more enduring be put in place on steel and aluminum, both to deal with the problems of trade in those commodities specifically, but also to better manage these high energy intensity product imports?
Steel and aluminum production are major carbon emitters, and tying quotas to how they are produced could favor U.S. and EU manufacturers, says Sagatam Saha at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. And so, for the Biden administration,
they kept the threat of the tariffs alive, and now they're using that toward notionally towards climate ends and to tackle the China issue.
But Saha expects that sorting all of this out will likely still take a while. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up, a quick lesson on kinetic energy.
You need steam, spin a turbine, create electricity.
First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 75 today. That's points, 0.2%, 34,000 to 576 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ climbed 12 points, almost 0.1%, 13,761. The S&P 500 added 6 points, about 0.1%, 44.57. For the week, the 5 days gone by, the Dow off 0.75%. The NASDAQ dropped 1.9%. S&P 500 slipped just about 1.3%. The payment systems Cash App and Square both spent a good chunk of the past 24 hours not working. Parent company Block says they're both mostly back online, but shares slipped almost 5.3% today. Smith & Wesson brand shot up 10.8% today after the gunmaker reported its quarterly sales and earnings were up from the same time a year ago. On the other hand, Rent the Runway, you say that 10 times fast, Rent the Runway cut its revenue projection for the fiscal year by as much as 10%. Shares fell almost 28%. Bond prices were up. When that happens, the yield goes down. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 4.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One of the other things that Austin Goolsbee said on this program yesterday, again, the president of the Chicago Fed, was that he doesn't think wage growth is a real good indicator of where inflation might be going. And touching on something else that he and I talked about, according to the most recent Beige book, the Fed's regular anecdotal look at this economy, businesses aren't that worried about it either. Companies in pretty much every Fed district said they expect wage growth to slow. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has that one.
Over the 12 months ending in June, wages grew by more than 4.5%. That's according to the government's latest employment cost index. Moody's analytics economist Dante D'Antonio says that is incredibly strong.
I mean, if you look through the entire decade from when the Great Recession ended through, you know, right before the pandemic started, wage growth was, you know, more likely to be in the 2-3% range over that entire period.
Wage growth is down from a high of just over 5% in June of last year. Glassdoor lead economist Daniel Zhao says he expects it to keep coming down, which will make it easier for employers to predict their labor costs.
Having to make mid-cycle adjustments, having to dole out bonuses or expand benefits packages makes their compensation costs less predictable.
Now, fewer bonuses and benefits may sound not so great for all of us workers. But while wage growth has been falling, inflation has been falling even faster.
So if you think of the race between wages and prices, wages are winning.
Aaron Dubay, a professor of economics at University of Massachusetts Amherst, says that means we can buy more. The fact that both wage growth and inflation are declining is a sign the economy is cooling, slowing down, says Glassdoor's Daniel Zhao.
Ideally, everybody would slow down at the same pace and get into a more safe and sustainable speed.
Because what the Fed is aiming for is less of a race and more of a Sunday drive. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Jobs, of course, are the prerequisite for getting wages. And the tail of the tape with the American labor market of late is that it's been slowing slowly. Gina and Amar and I talked about this. Job openings and hirings are falling gradually. Fewer people are quitting the jobs they have. And as Stephanie Hughes was just telling us, wage increases are moderating. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, as all of that is happening, it is hitting workers on the margins, especially younger workers, most of all.
Let's be clear. The labor market is still very good for most workers. But, says economist Bill Rogers at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, as job creation and hiring slow down,
that has started to have an adverse impact on the employment outcomes of out-of-school young adults.
Rogers, who speaks for himself, not the St. Louis Fed, is talking about 16 to 24-year-olds with no more than a high school diploma. He says while employment levels have held steady for most groups in recent months, the share of these younger workers who are employed has declined by about 5 percentage points.
They are at the bottom of the job ladder. They have the least amount of education. They have the least amount of skills. Many have structural barriers to work. Transportation challenges, issues around being an ex-offender, mental health.
And here's the problem, says Rogers.
These young adults, I call them canaries in the coal mine. Past research has shown when the economy slows down, they tend to be the first ones to lose their jobs.
Manny Rodriguez sees the problem firsthand at the nonprofit he runs in Chicago. Revolution Workshop provides pre-apprenticeship training to prepare young people for jobs in construction.
Especially youth in underserved communities, you know, they're starting from a negative start position. So when they start at a job, they're still only making $18, $19, $20 an hour at that point. And so when they get laid off, it hurts.
And Rodriguez says that could set them back further from getting more training and earning a living wage. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There are, according to the Greater Houston Partnership, 44 publicly traded oil and gas companies in Houston, Texas. That's out of 113 of them in the entire American economy. You throw in the hundreds and thousands, probably, of other energy companies there, and that is a very specific business ecosystem. But the city's reliance on an industry that's responsible for so very much of this planet's greenhouse gas emissions has now come face to face with changing times and a hotter planet. As Marketplace's Elizabeth Troval reports, there is a new kind of energy in town to help make the transition to a more sustainable future.
Way back in 1901, liquid gold gushed from the Spindletop oil field 80 miles east of Houston. The first Texas oil boom was on, and Houston became the energy capital of the world thanks to its growing port, critical railways, and nearby oil discoveries. That's Houston's energy past. But to talk about its energy future, well, we're going to have to go somewhere else, to Southwest Utah.
So yeah, here we are on the rig floor.
That's where Houston's Sarah Jewett describes the scene from a worksite she's monitoring. She previously led a fracking operation for 4 years for industry giant Schlumberger.
We are looking up at one of the last pieces of drill pipe that's going to drill the end of the horizontal lateral for our first well on this Frisco pad.
Now, she's not fracking for oil, but for steam. She's vice president of strategy for Fervo Energy, a Houston-based company focused on what's called enhanced geothermal.
You need steam, spin a turbine, create electricity.
Gabe Malik is chief of staff at Fervo Energy. He says in traditional geothermal, only certain parts of the world have the right kind of permeable rock and heat that can make enough steam for successful production.
We're using technology that allows us to create that steam in completely new locations by accessing hot rock and pumping water through that hot rock and bringing it back to the surface.
Malik says Fervo's use of oil and gas technology to drill and fracture rock underground makes geothermal cheaper and more feasible in more places. And that could be a game changer, since unlike wind or solar, geothermal is considered firm, clean energy. Sarah Jewett again.
These renewable energies that are
you know, not intermittent and not dependent on the weather, but that are producing all the time.
The company has started construction on a 400-megawatt geothermal project in southwest Utah, with more projects on the horizon.
There's so much demand for firm clean energy, and so we basically, at this point in time, feel like we can't build fast enough to meet the demand.
And Fervo is just one horse in this race.
In a changing energy world, we're very focused here in Houston on making sure that 10 years from now and 20 years from now and 40 years from now, Houston continues to be the energy capital of the world.
To stay a global leader, Bobby Tudor of investment firm Artemis Energy Partners says Houston needs to think beyond fossil fuels. And investment is growing. According to the Greater Houston Partnership, Houston-based energy transition firm secured $6.1 billion in financing from investors last year. That's up 62%. Tudor says he's particularly interested in Houston's role in storing and delivering clean hydrogen.
60% of the nation's dedicated hydrogen pipelines, of the nation's dedicated hydrogen pipelines, are in Greater Houston, Texas. 60%. So we have fantastic infrastructure.
That said, pressure to transition to clean energy in Texas comes at a time when the state is just trying to keep up with peak demand as extreme temperatures and a growing population strain the electric grid. While wind and solar have played an important role in keeping the AC blowing this summer.
We are short baseload capacity in Texas right now, so we're going to build a bunch of new natural gas-fired plants because that baseload capacity cannot currently be met with wind, solar, and batteries.
Tudor says just to meet growing electricity demand in the state, fossil fuels will continue to play a major role for now as Houston competes to remain an energy capital. In Houston, I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, a glimmer of hope for renters out there. Saw this on CNBC. There's a real estate technology company called RealPage, which is out with some interesting data. The company says rents in August this year were up just 0.28% from August a year ago, while rents a year ago were rising at an 11% annual clip. And the company points out rents are actually due for a big drop because the number of new rental units being built is at a 50-year high, 460,000 of them just this year. All right, we are out of here on a Friday. Not, of course, without your moment of economic context. A common refrain the past year or so has been that Americans are gloomy about the macro economy, but feeling pretty good about their own situations. Here is one possible reason why. The Federal Reserve released some new data today that shows household net worth hit a record last quarter, up 3.7% to $154.3 trillion. That is mostly on real estate and stock market gains. You, astute listener, will rightly point out that there is a big chunk of the population of this country that has neither real estate nor stock market holdings. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work. while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.